the television set, convince the FCC that, hey, only one consumer out of 100 needs that capability. The other 99 do not, and we'd be wasting a lot of money. So they got permission from the FCC to leave out the high-pass filter because 99% of the customers do not need it. The FCC agreed to that, if and only if the television manufacturer would agree to supply the high-pass filter free of charge on demand. So every television manufacturer who's selling a set in the United States has an agreement with the FCC. They will supply the needed high-pass filter if the customer requests it. That's the good news. The bad news is that the FCC did not follow through with one more step. They should have demanded that that piece of information be included in the owner's manual for the TV set. So 99% of the state television set owners do not know that. So if you have reason to believe that your set, because of the lack of the high-pass filter, is creating a third harmonic and creating interference, as long as your set is within reasonable manufacturer, no, it wasn't 40 years ago that it was made, that it's a three-year-old set, and it's made by a respected brand name, you can go to that manufacturer and say, I need the high-pass filter. You promised you would supply on demand. You add that high-pass filter to your TV set, and most of the time, the interference, if that was the cause of it, front-end overload creating the harmonic, most of the time, it'll cure it. On top of that, in my opinion, every case of television interference is curable. And we've already discussed some of the techniques. With the right kind of receiving equipment and a sniffer antenna, you can find out where it's coming from. Find out where the vulnerable stage is. And so many amateurs have added filters that they bought themselves. Many amateurs have gotten the filter from the manufacturer and added it. Quite often that fixes it. Moving the antenna, finding out which bands, which frequencies, doing a bunch of tests. By the time you fill up a notebook with enough tests of what band you're on, what end of the band you're on, what power you're running, how much interference you get, on what television channel, by the time you put that all together, you draw a picture that gives you a pretty clear path to a solution. You talk to the experts on TBI, every single television interference situation is curable. I didn't say it's simple, but if you've got the perseverance, every one of them is curable. KQKE1, KQLIW.
Roger, this is KQKE1. Well, back many years ago, I had a problem with TBI, 20 meters especially. And I don't remember where I saw it. I guess it could have been in one of the amateur radio handbooks at the time. They gave us somewhat of a novel, well, I shouldn't say novel, a scientifically very good way of curing the problem, and that was using a transmission line notch filter. And I can recall it now, how I made the filter. Basically, a transmission line notch filter, how can I describe it? The filter that you stick on the back of the transmitter box, basically, we would call that a lumped constant filter. And those filters were meant to really be notch at the odd harmonics, because you did mention you were getting a third, three times the frequency. So your low-pass filter is acting basically, from what I can visualize, as a notch filter as an odd harmonic, what will be a pass filter at the even harmonic. So basically what I'm saying is, if at that frequency, a notch filter at say 2, 4, or 6 times the frequency becomes a pass filter at 3, 5, and 7 times the frequency. So what you can do, there is a fact, I guess it may be covered in some of the handbooks. What I use, basically, I think it was called coaxial line bridge tape filter. Am I correct on that? It faded a little bit in my mind. but I'm bringing back basically what I did, over.
71IF1. 71IF1, I think you wanted to make a comment earlier. Thought of your name and your comment, sir.
Yeah, somehow I drifted off to another channel. Anyway, yeah, you got Bill in Stamford, Connecticut. Yeah, I've got a problem with that TVI also there. It's on 2 meters. I found that what happened is I can take my HT, I can go on 143.750 and walk around, and the closer I get to my neighbor's house, the stronger I can receive channel 17 off Cablevision. Back to you, Dick.
And that's a pretty strong piece of indication there, Bill, that your cable system is not very tight. In other words, there's a loose connector somewhere in the system, and whatever can egress can also ingress. In other words, a leakage of a connector in a cable TV system that contributes to what's called the cumulative leakage index, CLI, of a cable system is in violation of FCC rules and FAA rules, because they use some of the frequencies on some of those channels that would interfere with the FAA. So a loose connector on a telephone pole or in somebody's house, which allows the system to radiate, and you're picking it up with a handy-talkie, you should not be able to do that. And so walking around with a handy-talkie, using it as a sniffer, you will eventually find out where it's coming from. Now, there was an article in Technical Topics in QST Magazine about a year and a half ago about how to take a D connector in a coax cable system and create a stub tuner. That's what Mel's talking about. And I remember responding to that because it was a little bit of a math error, and I wrote a letter to the editor, and it got published in QST on how to make a stub tuner. You go to any of the really good books that ARL prints, I'm pretty sure you're going to find it in the appropriate chapter of the Amateur Radio Handbook. I think you're going to find it in the antenna book. You're certainly going to find it in the interference manual that the ARL publishes. How to make a D connector stub filter to make sure you've got a deep notch on some desired frequency, undesired frequency, out of your transmitter. And it is possible to make a notch filter that you put into the coax cable of the television set. There you've got to be a little bit more careful, because if you notch out one frequency, the stub does re-enter, and it could give you some grief on some other channel. You got to go a little bit careful. But putting in a T-connector notch filter, stub filter, and maybe a series of them on either transmission line, the one going to the TV set or the one coming from the ham radio going to that antenna, can make a particular frequency disappear. And there are times when that's a very desirable thing to do. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Basically, that's what I did. This is K2KEY. Am I correct? Just let me get it back in my head. Am I correct in saying that it was usually under what was known as a coaxial line, at that time, bridge T filter? Is that the correct method that was used at that time? Take over.
Yeah, guys, when you're ready. Now, there I'm not sure. Bridge T filter, I'm not sure. There I'm not sure. Bill, did you say you had a further comment?
Yeah, I wasn't finished. I know where the interference is coming from. It's coming from my neighbor's house next door. I've been having a problem with the people since 02. They're Spanish. They watch Channel 18. What they did is they've got coax running from the basement up to the second floor. And my guess is RGU-59 and not RGU-6, the stuff that's quad-shielded. It's given a problem. I contacted Mike Gruber. He sent them a letter. You know, they ignored it and everything, and it's been going back and forth between Cablevision and everybody else, and nobody seems to care or want to do anything about it. I guess I'll give it back to you, Dick. KB1IFY.
Yeah, it's not an easy one to solve, Bill, particularly what many a consumer, particularly a consumer that might have a language barrier problem, but still a consumer quite often will say to himself, gee, I just bought a $1,300 television set. If you, the ham radio operator living next door, didn't exist, I wouldn't have this problem. I mean, that's a very simplistic way that many a consumer will look at it. They don't realize that we all live in each other's pockets, so to speak. Modern-day living, we have very close living quarters, and we have to all coexist. You have an FCC license that allows you to transmit. Most likely, the equipment you use if it was manufactured in the last 30 years following current FCC rules, which means all harmonics out of equipment are more than 60 dB suppressed, and if their television set cable TV system was sufficiently shielded, they wouldn't have the problem. And so, in a case like that, you, if you're magnanimous enough, and some hands have done this, can volunteer to try to go into the house and fix the system. Well, depending on how the psychology happens, the way the problem is first brought up between the two parties in the two houses, quite often the neighbor will say, no, I don't want you touching my stuff. I don't want you in my house. The problem's on your end. I've got this expensive set. If you didn't exist, I wouldn't have the problem. Well, if they've got a closed mind like this, unfortunately, it eventually becomes almost a range war, so to speak. And how do you bring the right resources? Well, in some cases, if you bring in a third party, on Long Island, for instance, we have a television interference committee of qualified people recognized by the ARRL, recognized by the IEEE, who have a track record of fixing 20 or 30 or 40 TBI situations. If a third party, a very diplomatic human being, approaches that family and says, we have a solution, if you'll let us apply it, quite possibly that'll work. By now, it is possible that you and that neighbor are not in good speaking terms, and the chances of you getting permission to go in there and fix their leaking cable or to add a filter, there's a high probability they won't give you permission to do that. That's normal human nature, unfortunate. It's the black side of human nature, but it exists. So I think the only real solution, other than very calmly written letters, which probably will not work, is a third party, and that quite possibly your local amateur radio repeater group has or knows of a local television interference committee member who has a track record, and maybe if he's got Solomonic wisdom and really great psychology, he may be able to calm the nerves of that particular neighbor. I recommend you try to give that an attempt, Bill.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I recommend you try that. Back to you, Bill.
Yeah, well, they won't even let Cablevision in there to fix the problem. They're afraid they're going to charge them. Cablevision offered to fix it for free, but they just will not let them in there or anything, and they just want to be visible and everything else. So what are you going to do? I just thought I'd pass that along because I was listening to the TechNet, and the topic came up about the other bands, and this has been an ongoing problem for a long time over here, and basically, I was almost considering talking to legal counsel on that. KB1IFY, back to you.
Yeah, it's a tough one, Bill.
OEW?
How we recognize it's a tough one, Bill. And I think I understand why they don't want Cablevision coming into the house. When you read the rules and regulations of Cablevision, in theory, they're supplying you a piece of cable that's supposed to go to one television set. Quite possibly that neighbor has bought two, three, or four splitters, and they've got that cable coming into the house going to five separate sets. And they're afraid that if Cablevision finds that out, that they're going to be charged extra price for the monthly charge because so many sets are looking at the same piece of cable. So for a bunch of reasons, and maybe there's a language barrier, and they don't trust English-speaking people, and they're afraid to let them in the house. Quite possibly, Howie, you know of people who run into a similar problem, and how have they solved it? Back to you, Howie.
Very simply, I've had the problem here. Simply, you call the cable company will call the people and say, listen, we got to come in. The people say, no, the cable company cuts service because the cable company can get fined big time if they have leakage, and they're responsible. So if the cable company wants to put their foot down, all they got to do is just tell the people or their customer, look, we want to come in. We want to verify connections. If not, we're going to cancel the service. So what do you think? WDQHWW.
Yeah, I guess there's an extreme way to go, but maybe it's a possible solution. Now, quite possibly Cablevision in Connecticut will be a little reluctant to do that because they want as many customers as possible. They're going to be a little bit reluctant to threaten cancellation of a customer for fear that that customer will go over to DirecTV satellite reception or something like that. But best I can recommend is hang in there, Bill, and there's lots of stories like this where, unfortunately, they don't go away in a hurry because people harden their position and they point the finger in the other direction and say, it ain't me, it's you. I bought this $1,300 set, I want to watch it, and I wish you didn't exist. If you and your ham radio buddies didn't exist, I wouldn't have this problem. They quite often come up to that very simplistic, narrow-minded point of view, and it's a tough one. The best I could recommend, when a neighbor brings you a television interference complaint, you got to go very, very easy with them in the beginning. You got to sound compliant as all hell if you want to keep peace in the neighborhood. You got to offer things like, until we solve the problem, tell me when your favorite television watching program is on, and I'll stay off for that particular hour. You could offer that. Not everybody's willing to do that. I understand that. But you got to sound very compliant in the beginning, at least, in order to try not to get the situation to escalate. Because once the situation escalates, and you got people shouting at each other and threatening legal suits and whatever, it becomes a runaway, it becomes a range war, and it becomes a mob rule type philosophy, in which case it becomes a lot more difficult to recover the situation. So my recommendation to ham radio operators, not everyone's going to agree with this, is try to sound extremely compliant and very easygoing when this is first brought to your attention. I bet you've heard of cases like this in Brooklyn, Mel. K2KUY,
K2LIW. Yep, Roger, this is K2KUY. Oh, I had tons of complaints and all, especially with 6 feet of fun years ago. High power at 6 meters for a while, fooling around with that. That was not really conducive to making good friends around the neighborhood. In fact, lucky, I guess, that's still alive. All right, let me just finish up on this. So as I was saying on this particular problem that we're having here, if you look into a bridge-type T-filter that's made with a piece of coax, I had a lot of success with it on this particular problem. And basically what it'll be will be a quarter wavelength section of coax, and that you'll cut it, and you will find that you will be able to have a situation that actually what it will do, it will in your case, you have a low-pass filter, so let's say the low-pass filter is going to notch. Right now, it's notching 2 times, 4 times, or 6 times the frequency of 20 meters, and passing right now 3 times, or 5 times, or 7 times the frequency from what I understand. So now with this, with a transmission line filter, is that's exactly what it's going to do. It's going to take out the odd harmonic, and the low-pass filter is going to take out not the even harmonic. It's a very simple way of doing it. I can say you look that up and you'll see it's very easy. I think I had to add approximately, I made it up with the coax cable, which was about maybe 10, 12 feet long or whatever it came out to, and worked excellent. So that's a very simple answer to it. You would believe how well a transmission line notch filter could work. All right, shall we go on? Try one more, Dick.
Yes, KQRIW. Isn't the low-pass filter just going to cut everything above 45 megahertz?
That's exactly what I was going to say. If you've got a low-pass filter, Mel, of good design, and if it has a cutoff frequency of, let's say, 40 megacycles, it should pass everything from DC to 40 megacycles with only a fraction of a decibel of insertion loss, and it starts its roll-off at 40 megacycles, and by the time it gets to 50, it should be rolling off by, let's say, 60 dB, and if it's a good design, the roll-off region of 60 dB down, starting 50 megacycles and above, should stay there for the next 100 or so megacycles. A low-pass filter of good design shouldn't allow signals to start coming back in until you get to a few hundred megacycles. A low-pass filter really should pass nothing but low. Yes, there are kinds of filters that will take out the odds and leave the evens, take out the evens and leave the odds. There are kinds of filters like that. That is not a good design low-pass filter. And the same thing with a high-pass filter. Look, every filter, if you go far enough for frequency, has what's called the re-entrance characteristic. But that re-entrance characteristic, if it's a good design, should be almost 10 times higher in frequency than the rollout frequency before it starts to re-enter. That's a low-pass filter of good design, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel. And yes, you can go to the next one.
Yeah, Dick, he can get a used filter, like a Drake or a Johnson.
Yep, and they do fill that characteristic that I described, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, this is KQKY, final words on it. A few years ago, they did a review of low-pass filters. I don't remember, I think it was covered in communications quarterly. Yes. They took all the popular ones, as you just mentioned, Johnson and Drake and who else? Collins. And they took all these filters and they tested them. They did a test on them and they gave you really, you know, what their attenuation of harmonics will do. Almost every one of them was really notching, would really notch, really excellent notch, 50, 55, 60 dB or whatever it was, at two times the fundamental frequency. But had a tendency in some times that when you had a problem, like you say, when you needed the notch, especially in an area where three times the harmonic was more or less needed, emphasized more or less. In this area, basically, the problem fell, the real problem, of course, fell with all the amps here on channel 2, around 54 megahertz. But in other areas, I guess, where channel 2 was not as prevalently used as maybe channel 3 and all, it was a different situation. And so the filters, like they explained in the article, will maybe be very effective for cleaning up your problem on channel 2. There have been complaints that sometimes on one of the other audit channels or whatever that you just may find a harmonic that will slip through and maybe it's strong enough coming out of your rig or whatever and give you a problem. So the idea was on the TV, the CVI committee, I remember reading this, that to take out this odd situation, they recommended, and I believe they called it at the time, a bridge P filter, and it was made up with a length of coax, and Dick, I know I did it, and it worked quite well. Go ahead.
I hear you. There could be a little bit of confusion here, Mel, in that let's assume now a filter is a low-pass filter design where the design is no worse than 40 dB of rejection of the higher frequencies than the cutoff frequency. And so a filter may have 40 dB of rejection and better at all frequencies above, let's say, 45 megacycles for a transmitter filter. And when you look at that filter, in the reject region, it's got, when you've got a 100 decibel display device, you will see a scalloped pattern where it looks like a rectified sine wave, and some of those notches go down to 110 dB. And then you have regions in between those notches where it comes up to minus 40 dB. That's still a good design, where it's better than 40 dB everywhere in the reject region, even though there's some places in between where it's got deeper notches. The fact that it's got deeper notches is not bad. Just that you've got to be careful not to misinterpret that, the fact that it's coming up to 40 dB of rejection in between a pair of 110 dB notches. There are people who look at a decibel display and get confused, and they'll think that that's a serious reentrance. If it's a 40 decibel design, that may be a very good design, even though it gives that appearance. My impression of a properly designed low-pass filter is that no substantial amount of energy above the cutoff frequency will come back through that filter until you get to about 10 times higher frequency than cutoff. If it's got a 40 meg cutoff, I would like to see essentially no rejection, no re-entrance characteristics until you get well below, well above 400 megacycles. And by then the problem should be gone, because very few cables are going that high, if you know what I mean. And nowadays, except for you and I, Mel, everybody's on cable. I'm the one human being that I think in Huntington is still using a rooftop antenna. I think you're the one human being in Brooklyn that is still using a rooftop broadcast, over-the-air broadcast antenna. And as you know, February of 2009, I think it is, over-the-air ordinary television broadcast will cease to exist. You and I have got a year and a third to start thinking about what we're going to do. K2KEY, KQRIW.
This is W2EL repeater. Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, of course, you're correct. I am one of the few here, but not much of the TV watching, so nothing much that will miss other than having to do or a program maybe that's of interest on PBS. As far as that goes, well, just as the gentleman just said, get a neighbor that you can have that has still an antenna, a little old lady, that still has a 17-inch black and white TV set. And if you have a problem getting into that TV set, and without you, I can tell you, without you around, I have no complaints about how my TV plays. And I'm very happy it is. It has to be only you. So there you are. And I know you are not going to touch my TV because you'll ruin it. So, what do you do? And if you could find what the complaint is, in many cases, you may just have to do a little bit more. I just say, the cutoff may be sufficient on a low-pass filter and all, but sometimes it's not what fits the bill for that particular band that you're operating, because you have to be, the problem is when you're operating, say, a part of 20 meters. So sometimes you've got to just think about, when I'm operating this band, what do I have to add in to the system or do to it to get 20 meters out of the next door neighbor's situation there? So this is what I'm saying. Sometimes you can just engineer a type of notch filter that will give you sufficient sufficient rejection and, you know, notches, so that it will really cure the problem. And I think specifically this is one of the things this person is having as a problem stick over.
Yeah, it's the raw materials to do your solution, to build the stub T, the T-connector stub filter is what I call it. It's probably got a bunch of other names. There's a lot of articles you can find on the subject. The raw materials to do it are only going to cost a dollar or three, and it's certainly worth a try. I would do it. You can go to another one if you want to, Mel. KQRIW.
Roger. That's what I had. That was my four-man low-pass filter that I couldn't afford to buy a low-pass filter, and that's how I made myself a four-man low-pass filter, just as you said, with a piece of coax cable. And it did the job for me. Of course, covered was for 20 meters, and that was all I was looking for at the time. So if I would have had, you know, problems on other bands, I guess I could have made up a number of them. All right, very good. So that's basically it. All right, let's go on with antennas here. You look at an antenna. How can you tell me when you look at an antenna if you can get an approximate idea of the efficiency of this antenna? Like, for instance, I'm looking at ones that they sell here for either mobile use or for home use. And if I take the measurement, can I get an idea of the efficiency, in fact, using a measurement of a 40-meter vertical? How do I tell the efficiency of this? Well, I got a couple answers for that, but go ahead, then.
Yeah, when it comes to antenna efficiency, there's about three definitions. The best definition, in my opinion, is conservation of energy. If I put 100 watts into an antenna, and if that antenna is 99% efficient, 99 watts are going to be radiated by that antenna somewhere into space. That's the most reasonable definition. In the case of a 40-meter antenna as a ground plane, a vertical ground plane, even if you follow the manufacturer's recommendation, and he says you're going to have a minimum of 4 ground plane radials, and you lay down exactly 4, you're not covering the ground enough. I mean, in the case of a ground plane vertical quarter-wave antenna, if you want high efficiency, unfortunately, you've got to lay down a lot of copper. The customer, the vendor doesn't tell you that for fear that you'll reject his brand name. What's happening is you're feeding the antenna power into the earth around the antenna, heating up the earth, which is a good dummy load, and keeping the worms warm in the wintertime. That inefficiency you can't blame on the antenna. Real efficiency of an antenna from a conservation of energy point of view recognizes the fact that when you take that valuable 100 watts of energy coming out of your particular transmitter and you apply it down that transmission line, there's only 3 things that an antenna can do with it. Number 1, it can radiate into space. That's good. Number 2, if it's got some standing wave ratio, it can reflect some of it back to the transmitter. The standing wave ratio bridge will tell you about that one. And number 3, it can burn up the power by I squared R heating, thermal resistive heating. That one's easy to detect. Also, from the second bad one, standing wave ratio, your standing wave ratio meter, your bird watt meter, in the forward and reverse mode will tell you that you're reflecting energy back to the transmitter. And you can usually correct that. But number 3, you've got an easy way of detecting that one. You press the key down on the transmitter, you adjust the transmitter to a power output where your rig can run key down. Maybe half power output, it can do that. Some rigs only in the tuned mode can do that. But if you've got a tuned mode where you're allowed to run it continuously, and maybe 50 watts output is the mode, and you press the key down for 10 solid minutes with 50 watts of output, then you turn off the transmitter, you run out there and touch everything. If anything is dissipating more than a watt or two, something's going to get hot, and you're going to feel it. If you touch everything with your hand, and it's ice cold, then it's not wasting the power in heat, and if it doesn't have any standing wave ratio, it's not reflecting the power. There's only one thing left. It's sending it out of that antenna. Now, maybe it's coming...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Maybe that energy coming out of the antenna is being coupled into the earth, which you can't blame on the antenna. Like that comes back to you because you didn't put down enough ground plane radio. So efficiency, your hand and your visual meter will tell you what the efficiency is, and you can measure it. Now, there's one other crazy kind of efficiency the VHF guys get into, and they call it main lobe efficiency. They try to figure out how much energy is in the main lobe versus the side lobe. I recommend you don't go there. That's a strongly misunderstood area, and let's not go there. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Well, he describes the antenna here. He says, 40-meter vertical ground mounted, 14 feet high, and has a loading coil in the center. Requires 7 radios, and at resonance, the FWR is 1.0. What would you say is the efficiency of this antenna? Well, I'll just say a few more words on it. The total resistance of the, actually what we call total resistance of an antenna is really what we call the RR plus RL. So that means basically what we're talking about, if I want to break it down, is that the resistance of the antenna and the loss together will equal RC, or let me put it here this way. All right, let's talk about this antenna. Maybe I'm getting off here a little too much about, you know, the radiation resistance, the RR. The antenna at 40 meters being 14 feet tall, at 7 megahertz, a free space, as we call, the wavelength would be, in feet, would be 984 divided by frequency of 7 megahertz, or 140.6 feet, or as in meters, as do we many times, of course, refer to it, come to 43 meters. That 40 meters is actually would wind up at 43 meters. So if we were to take the formula, efficiency in percent is 100 times 4, would be 4, because if we look at it this way, that 14 feet of would represent 0.1 wavelength. I'm trying to picture it. Let me get this straight here. Yeah. 14 feet on 40 meters would represent then 0.1 wavelength. So the radiation resistance would actually wind up at about, let me do a quick count, around 4 ohms of radiation. The RR would become then about 4 ohms. So if we put that into a formula for efficiency, which would be 100 times radiation resistance divided by the line impedance, which would be 50 ohms. So you'd have 100 times 4 divided by 50 approximately.
Time out.
Yeah, I've seen that kind of a calculation, Mel, and I disagree with it. Many a person has thought that that's good common sense. And yes, you do have a radiation resistance, and you have a loss resistance, R sub R and R sub L. However, real efficiency is the only way an antenna can be inefficient is to turn the energy into heat that you put into it. And if his hand tells him that antenna is cold when he puts 50 watts into it for 10 minutes, it can't be inefficient. Now, along these lines, with this philosophy I've just given you, I have talked one of my clients into recently purchasing a thermal imaging camera, because at UHF frequencies on handheld products, these are the antennas that I design as an occupation. Quite often the customer has got very little space left on the printed circuit board inside of a handheld package of this computer or scanner or whatever it is, and he wants a zillion antennas in there. And sometimes those antennas really end up with 40% efficiency. In other words, 60% of the power you put into that antenna ends up heating up the printed circuit board, heating up the plastic around the antenna, heating up the resistive contacts of the antenna itself, because it doesn't have an efficient socket to it, and so on. And how can you find out where the inefficiency is happening? Well, what we do is put half a watt of power into the antenna for 30 seconds and look at it with a thermal imaging camera and find out what's getting hot. A good thermal imaging camera can resolve a little bit more than a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature. And if you've got something that's wasting 60% of your power, most likely at the half-watt level, something in there is running 30 degrees higher than normal room temperature, if you know what I mean. You're going to see it on the thermal imaging camera right away as gangbusters. So the only true inefficiency of an antenna is where it's wasting your RF energy. Let me drop. By turning it into heat, there is no other mechanism of inefficiency, particularly when you combine it with the IEEE definition of antenna gain. The IEEE, Antennas and Propagation Society, in their dictionary of measurement procedures, says that gain is that property you measure of an antenna after you have impedance matched it. In other words, after you've corrected for all standing wave ratio problems. So, this calculation of radiation resistance versus real impedance, I've seen those calculations, and it doesn't recognize the fact that an infinitesimal dipole a tenth of a wavelength dipole can be 100% efficient. I've seen it. I've done it. I've done it with a real imaging camera. I've made antennas that are small than the proper size. They become very narrow band. They become very high in Q. They become very difficult to impedance match. But you can approach 100% efficiency if you recognize who's eating your lunch, as I say. I mean, if you've got a lossy piece of plastic nearby, it's time you replace it with Teflon. If you've got lousy contacts, it's time you silver plate them, or gold plate them, and so on. So the methods of inefficiency, which are thermal, can be recognized, can be measured, can be cured. That 40-meter antenna, if it runs ice cold, cannot be inefficient. The only other remaining technique, even though it's only a tenth of a wavelength high, it's a compressed antenna, it's got loading coils, it can't be inefficient, other than coupling energy into Earth, because it's so close to Earth and there's not enough ground plane radios. If you want full efficiency out of a ground plane antenna, there are smart people who think you can only get that if you lay down 32 ground plane radios. I'm not saying I agree with them, but there's some smart people who set that as the number of where you get near 100% efficiency. And you can't blame that on the antenna, in my opinion. Not everybody's going to agree on this one. This is a tough one. I know it. KQKUI, KQRIW.
Yeah, what he was asking is, can you give him a ballpark efficiency, you know, percentage-wise on his antenna? Now, if we the RT, total resistance, can we say that is equal to the radiation resistance plus the loss resistance? In other words, is R and RR and RL effectively in theory?
Absolutely. With a particular model, they are in series. And if that antenna is made out of good materials, in my opinion, Mel, the RR is going to be an extremely small fraction of the RT. You'd have to use materials with carbon granules in them to get the kind of inefficiency that your first assumption was sort of indicating. You can't make an antenna that bad unless you put nichrome wire in it, if you know what I mean. And that every antenna I have ever seen, if it passes the cool hand test with 50 watts, and if it's a 100-watt antenna, you put 50 watts into it for 10 minutes, and if it runs ice cold, in my mind, it has no mechanism left to be inefficient. Back to you, Mel, KQLIW.
So if we assume that RT is equal to RR plus RL, would it be correct that if we use efficiency, I mean, I remember seeing this in years in the book, that if we use the formula hundreds of times RR divided by RT, is that really a good representation of the efficiency of an antenna takeover?
You put only RR in the numerator, and you put RT in the denominator, and you multiply by 100%. That is the percentage of inefficiency. You're really evaluating RR as a percentage. And that's good piece of information. If I knew my antenna is 10% inefficient, I could say it's 90% efficient. So I'm going to accept that formula in that form. But when it comes to real antennas, like the one that I think he's got, it is my belief that the RT, our loss is an extremely small fraction of the R total. And if it was not so, if what I said was not true, then something would be getting hot when he put 50 watts into it for 10 minutes. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, now that's what I was going to get to now, the SWR. If we were to assume that this was 100% efficient, and we still, of course, going to use, because it's 0.1 wavelength, and we assume that RR now is 4 ohms, then would the SWR in this situation be 50 divided by 4? And in other words, without the matching network, that if we took then, 50 and divided by 4, we would have an SWR on this antenna without its matching network of actually 12.5. Am I on the right track with all this thinking, Dick? Over.
Yes, you are. If you didn't use some form of impedance matching network, and if the 4 ohms was really the radiation resistance of a 10th wavelength antenna, and there's ways of looking that up, then yes, that 12.5:1 standing wave ratio would be real. But no real self-respecting amateur is going to tolerate a 12:1 standing wave ratio under normal circumstances. And a good impedance matching network in the right location will correct that. And a good impedance matching network, antenna tuner, or call it what you like, is capable of running at 98% efficiency, even though it's matching at 12.5:1, down to 1:1. A good one can handle that. You may not like the bandwidth. Every time you QSY 50KC, you've got to retune everything. I can understand that. You may not like that. That's the disadvantage of a high-vis wire antenna. But if you're smart enough to buy a good antenna tuner, that is a very handleable condition. I can give you overall 97% efficiency, as long as you are not including as inefficiency this lack of enough ground plane radio jazz that I talked about earlier. So to make an antenna inefficient, you have to have lossy materials on board. So maybe he's got a loading coil in there. Maybe the loading coil is made out of wire that's not big enough in diameter, in which case he'll find out real fast. With 50 watts for 10 minutes, his hand is going to tell him that that loading coil is getting hot. And by how many watts of dissipation, his hand can estimate that. He can find out what is the ballpark of his inefficiency if he has it. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, roger, roger. Very good. Yeah, no, I'm just saying that this is basically what I was saying. If I looked at this, if I was asked this question, basically this is how I would do an evaluation on it. All right, but, if you take any of these short antennas, as you were saying, and made it highly efficient by minimizing your RL, your loss resistance, it's definitely that the SWR, may be high even at resonance, but when, like you say, with a matching network, you can, of course, make it work quite well. So, again, that's what they basically, I know what he's talking about, his antenna, without mentioning names. This is what they're selling, the vertical, the 14 feet high, and it's got this loading coil in it. Actually, it's a company makes mobile antennas, but they show you that you can utilize, basically, they're telling you that they sell you this pole to utilize your mobile antennas. In other words, the 40-meter resonator can be used also if you want to have a fixed location or put on, if your car, you're parking, if you actually get this extra added piece of pole. So it takes it from 8 feet with the loading coil up to 14 feet and supposedly gives you a much more efficient antenna. Because I hate to tell you, I've done this and all, and I evaluated what it is at its regular 8 feet versus its 14 feet, but I don't think we'll get into that thing. K2RIW, K2KY.
Yeah, I know you guys at the Kings County Radio Club have had these periodic shootouts in which multiple mobile antennas are installed on vehicles. You guys bring them to the Floyd Bennett Field, a nice big open field, and you go out and make measurements of field strength. Now, with a long whip or a short whip, on an automobile, on frequencies like, we'll say, 14 megacycles, 20-meter ham band, where there is no good ground plane radio system, your only counterpoise is the automobile itself. And whether that whip be long or short, top-loaded, center-loaded, base-loaded, in that particular environment, you're going to get some huge differences in an apparent efficiency. When I say apparent efficiency, I mean you are making measurements of field strength at some given distance at Floyd Bennett Field, a very good, worthwhile test to do. And when you guys see inefficiency, It may not be because the antenna is getting hot. It may be because the earth underneath the automobile is getting hot. Underneath that concrete runway you got the car parked on, or the macadam or the asphalt runway is parked on, underneath the dirt is getting hot. Because you've got a really terrible counterpoise on 14 megacycles when you're using an automobile. And in that particular environment, putting the loading coil higher up, making the whip longer, trying to get the phase center of the antenna higher off the ground, all of these things can make a huge difference in what I call apparent efficiency, where you're including ground loss. And so I'm calling it apparent efficiency because, in my mind, the inefficiency of an antenna tells me how hot the antenna is not getting. But there's another whole school of thought here. Mobile antennas, that's another entirely different environment, and it's a tough environment. Back to you, Mel, KQLIW.
KQ2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Mr. QIQ.
Good evening, Vic. KQ2QIQ, name is Glenn. Just a quick, I was doing some modeling, and I ran across those same equations with the antenna loss, and I started doing a lot of those calculations, and I found out the efficiency of the antenna. In on all my spreadsheets, NAVCAD equations, the efficiency is worse than others. I threw the question out to a whole bunch of different people, and here were some of the answers that I got. And one of the reasons why the antenna actually may not be getting hotter, but the efficiency still could be dropping. And the way it was explained to me is that the permeability of an antenna has a field of being an H field on the outside is a permeability of one, unlike a transformer that has the field is very, very concentrated in the high permeability, so that our radiation with respect to the feed line loss, or that ratio, would show up directly on the metal antenna in the feed line. But actually, because the feed line and the H field are right angles to each other, and it's actually leaving the antenna at a rate, actually that efficiency loss is actually between the air and the ground. So those losses may be very difficult to measure because they're simple temperature meters right on the antenna itself.
Yep. I hear the philosophy, Glenn, and I've got some real problems with it. First of all, at any frequency you and I are likely to use on any American ham band, there absolutely positively is no heating of the air. That air has a dielectric constant of 1008. It is so close to the same dielectric constant of a vacuum. And the air itself, if you calculate its loss of tangent, in other words, its ability to absorb RF energy and turn it into heat, is nearly zero. You have to go to one of the absorption bands in the near-infrared region before you can start making air have loss. And even then, you need a fraction of a mile of air to even see that loss. So air doesn't have loss. Now, if your particular antenna, because of a lack of counterpoise, like an automobile-mounted 20-meter vertical, is launching a substantial amount of its RF energy into the earth that's under the antenna, I'm going to give you that. That's a real inefficiency, and yes, it's hard to measure. And that's what the guys at the shootouts at Floyd Bennett Field have attempted to measure. They set another vehicle up a given distance away and measure field strength as people put on the same number of watts for automobile A and B and C and D and these various antennas. You can measure a kind of efficiency for that particular environment. What I'm objecting to, let me drop, is now we've got a bit somewhat difficult definition of what is the inefficiency. If my antenna runs ice cold, and it doesn't have the ability to heat up the air, if the antenna is running ice cold, every watt I put into it that's not being reflected back to me, and I can correct that with a good antenna tuner, if none of the wattage I put into the antenna is reflected back, I put 100 watts into the antenna, and less than a watt comes back to me, and if the antenna runs ice cold, then the antenna is doing what it is designed to do. It is launching that signal off of that antenna. Now, the next step you and I care about is it really going into the ether? Is it going into the ionosphere? Is it going there with a low enough radiation angle that I'm going to hear the DX that I care about. I also care about polarization, but I don't have much control over that. Faraday location is going to kill me. And depending on what kind of soil my automobile is driving over, if my automobile is driving over nice, salt-laden soil near the seashore, I'm going to get one kind of efficiency. And if I'm driving over the dry sand of the Mojave Desert, I'm going to get another kind of efficiency. And can we blame that on the antenna? That's a tough one. In theory, if I make the whip longer, if I make the loading coil higher, if I raise the phase center of the emission point of the antenna and move it further away from Earth, I can make greater efficiency of real signal sent out into the air as opposed to coupled into the ground. And so what words are we going to use to describe this kind of efficiency? I guess I would call it signal strength, emitted signal strength efficiency. To call it antenna efficiency, where the people who have a good physics background will talk about inefficiency of an antenna as I squared R heating loss. And if the antenna is running ice cold, then we've got a problem of terms. And we've also got a problem of definition of what really works the best. You see where I'm going here. And this is not an easy one. Oh boy, we amateurs are going to be discussing this issue for decades to come. You probably just prefer the words you want to give us on this one, Glenn. Yeah. KD2QIQ, K2RIW in the tech mask.
No, I think you explained it very well, and it's just hard to put these definitions in. It's just funny that when you're working on a spreadsheet or working these equations out in MathCAD, the first thing that comes up is that you start looking at, you know, full length antennas and efficiency because the radiation resistance becomes equal or greater than E line resistance. So the efficiency numbers start looking fantastic, and then you start trying to put a physical mechanism to that, and that's where it becomes difficult, and you start looking at other things. And it was just interesting that one of the things that was brought up was that, you know, in the number of times it takes the energy to build up inside the antenna and swing till you have very good coupling in the air, that actually there is between the time that the signal is leaving the radiating element to the air to the outside of it, and because it is traveling anticipated over many, many miles, that way of describing me is that because of that ratio of radiation resistance to the feedline resistance, that actually the hysteresis loss becomes a larger and larger area, and that area is distributed directly around the full signal area of the antenna, leaving the antenna itself. And there again, it wouldn't necessarily keep the metal, but the loss is actually taking place, so you're not getting as much signal energy into the air that you normally would on a full length antenna. But here again, I have nothing to prove it by. Back over to you, Dick.
Yeah, we've only got 3 minutes or 2 minutes left. Hysteresis loss is something that takes place usually in dielectric materials. If I've got a lossy piece of plastic, what is the mechanism of the plastic giving me loss when my ohmmeter tells me it's got the 10 to the 10 ohms of resistance? It is a pure non-conducting material. The only mechanism it has for giving us loss is hysteresis loss. And it's called loss tangent. And if you study what's going on, there's the electrons going around each molecule of the plastic. They shift their orbit as opposed to the positive and negative waves of the RF being subjected to, and it does it with a lag, and that is the loss mechanism. So hysteresis loss is something you can have in a plastic, in a dielectric material, and Earth itself is a partial dielectric material, partial conductive material. And yes, it has a mechanism of hysteresis loss. And do you blame that on the antenna? Because if you've given the antenna insufficient counterpoise, insufficient ground plane radials, then some of the signal, by the laws of physics, must be coupled into Earth, and therefore is heating the Earth. Do you blame that on the antenna because you mounted that poor antenna on a yucky automobile? I've got a problem with that one, as you can tell. Mel, we're within 1 minute. I think you and I have to start signing off. Glenn, I think we have to bring this one back because I know we haven't finished this one. This is a toughie. K2KEY, yep. Time for your final comments there, Mel. K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, roger, roger. I was going to get into, I decided to really think about what I was going to get into with the vertical antenna, get back to basically what we were talking about, the vertical antenna, and the radiation resistance is a really a function of the height of the antenna and wavelength. So we can, you know, discuss that about also about loss resistance, how that figures in and all. But I think just about out of time. So good night all, thank you, and we'll try to pick up on this next week. Take care, Dick. Have a great week.
Yep, be kind to each other, you guys. 73 you all, bye-bye for now. And as long as the sea doesn't rise, Mel and I will be back next week, tackling some more of these conundrums, these really tough ones. Bye-bye.